ISEGR colloquium. I am Tom Morehouse. I'm with the Institute. And before a group of Alaskans, it would probably be presumptuous of me to attempt to introduce Senator Greening. In fact, perhaps that would be the case before any group of citizens. He is a man whose career has certainly spanned not only a long period, but has cut across several dimensions of American national and as well as Alaska state policy and public affairs. It covers journalism, politics, and in politics he's been a leader in areas of foreign and domestic policy. He's been a crusader against he's been an anti-colonialist. He's been a strong statehood advocate for both Alaska and Hawaii. He's been a leader in areas of civil rights and civil liberties, and areas of education and many others. And I couldn't begin really even to summarize, except hit a few arbitrary highlights from this remarkable career. His topic today leaves him plenty of leeway because it's listed as Alaska Politics 1939 to 1972, which is a third of a century. Yet that only covers part of the many things and the many events in which Ernest Greening has participated and been a leader over many years. And I'd like to turn it over to you, Senator Greening.
Well, we're in the presence of an historic event of great importance and great significance to Alaska, and which should concern us. And I'm referring to the action of the Secretary of the Interior, Rogers Morton, which was publicized yesterday, in withdrawing some 83 million acres of the Alaska domain for parks, wildlife, refuges, wild rivers, and so forth. And this relates not only to the present and future, but to our past history. I consider this action one of the most disastrous acts that has occurred to Alaska in our over a century of history. And I feel it imperative to alert the people of Alaska as to what this means. This originated a few months ago with an amendment to the Native Claims Act. Native Claims Act, as you know, is an act that attempted to do belated justice and economic equality to the native people of Alaska by providing them with some 40 million acres of land and a substantial sum of money. And legislation that was long overdue and was very desirable. But inserted into this legislation and completely irrelevant to it was another provision that the Secretary of the Interior could set aside up to 80 million acres of land for these other purposes. It was amazing to me, not only in retrospect but at the time, that so completely an irrelevant provision would come into this act. It had nothing to do with native claims. It had nothing to do with their need of land. And it was amazing that the Alaska delegation in Congress didn't fight it and say, well, let's wait a minute. This is an important issue. It should not be inserted at the last minute into another bill. If it's desirable, it should be subject to special legislation, which will be presented in a special bill on which hearings should be held. No hearings were held, and it went through. Now, some months later, Secretary of the Interior Morton has also immediately violated the law, which provides that he is privileged or he is authorized to withdraw up to 80 million acres. He has calmly added 3 million acres of Alaska domain, which is an illustration of the indifference and contempt which different bureaucrats have for Alaska. 3 million acres is a lot of land. He's added to it just as if it were a 50 by 100 house lot. By withdrawing all this land and keeping it out of use permanently, because about one third of it is going to be for parks, another third of it for wildlife refuges, he is going to paralyze, largely jeopardize, the economy of Alaska. The people of Alaska have a right to be able to explore and develop the natural sources that lie within that area. But if they're in national parks and in wildlife refuges, they will be forever barred from public use and private development. Now, this is not an unprecedented action. We've been accustomed to such actions by previous Secretaries of the Interior. Some years ago, Secretary of the Interior Ickes arbitrarily withdrew a lot of land in the Kenai Peninsula to create the Alaska Moose Range without any consultation of the people of Alaska. Just did it arbitrarily with a stroke of the pen, which was further going to be complicating our problem because underneath that was a very valuable oil and gas resource. Secretary Seaton, with a stroke of the pen, on virtually his last day in office, withdrew the 10 million acres of the Alaska Arctic Wildlife Range. He did that after the Senate had held hearings on this subject, hearings conducted by Alaska Senator Bob Bartlett, which came to the conclusion that this withdrawal was unwise, unnecessary, and undesirable, and should not prevail. And despite the finding of the United States Senate expressing the wishes of the people of Alaska, Secretary Seaton withdrew it. And then we came to Secretary Stuart Udall, who, when he was up for confirmation before the Interior Committee, spoke very fervently in favor of public power, said he was a public power advocate, and criticized the preceding outgoing Republican administration, President Eisenhower, by saying the Republicans and the Eisenhower administration considered public power an evil, but that he and his fellow Democrats considered it a public good. But when this great Rampart project, which was endorsed by the Corps of Engineers, was about ready to go, which would have supplied large quantities of low-cost power not only to Alaska, but under modern methods of transmission could be transmitted even to the states, he started a campaign against it because, in his view, the lake, which would be formed behind the Rampart Dam, would flood the Yukon Flats, which is, in his view, contained the invaluable nesting grounds of ducks and geese. And this is also part of the withdrawal that Secretary Morton has made. Now, there is an effort being made to reestablish, to revitalize the Rampart Project, which has been largely promoted by the great energy shortage. If Rampart Dam had been allowed to continue, it would be almost ready for action now. And one of the candidates for the Senate, Richard Gruhl, has announced that if elected, he will promote the project. And more recently, Senator Stevens has announced and called me to tell me so, that he will revive the Rampart Project. Well, if the nesting grounds on the Yukon Flats are withdrawn, of course there can be no Rampart Dam, because that will be withdrawn forever. Now, this statement that these are invaluable nesting grounds is as unreliable and as untrustworthy in its implications as many statements that are made out by extremist conservationists. I'm a conservationist, I hope a fervent one, and I think I've demonstrated in that past. But to say that in all Alaska there would be no other nesting grounds for these ducks, to say that along the borders of this lake, which would have several thousand miles of shorefront, there wouldn't be no more nesting grounds, is absurd. And at that time, a campaign was started to mobilize the so-called sportsmen against the Rampart Dam, and Secretary Udall and Ira Gabrielson, who was then the head of an organization financed by the gunmakers, spread the slogan that if Rampart Dam were built, there would be one less duck in every California sportsman's bag. I felt I could live with that. I didn't think that was an unspeakable and irredeemable calamity. But that prevailed, and Udall told me personally, he said, we can't afford to antagonize the sportsmen. Well, of course, this was all in the interest of conservation, but I would say that there were nobler forms or evidences of conservation than to save the ducks up here in order to blast them from the skies down there. But it was on that basis that Rampart Dam was knocked off, arbitrarily, although it had been warmly supported by the Congress and warmly supported by the Alaska legislature and by all Alaska officials. And now we come full circle to the same thing, but with one fundamental difference. These previous arbitrary acts of secretaries of the interior took place while Alaska was a territory. Since that time, we've had statehood, and we had every reason to believe, to assume, and hope that after statehood, when we were presumably masters in our own domain, this would cease, but apparently it hasn't. Now, if this goes through, and it still has to be approved by the Congress, it means that in this vast area, there could be no economic development of any kind. Can't be done in the parks, can't be done in the wildlife refuges. That means that, for instance, very important minerals, which we have reason to believe and in many cases know exist in the subsoil of Alaska, will be forever denied our government and our people. We are already running short of these minerals, just as we're running short of energy. They include such necessary minerals as chrome, manganese, antimony, nickel, copper, and others. If we're not allowed to explore them, of course, we can't actually locate them. And this may be a very serious blow to national defense at some future time. And that would be only one of many reasons why this decision should be reversed if possible. And it's perfectly absurd. Now, I think I'm familiar with the present status of national parks. We have three magnificent national parks here. We have Mount McKinley, we have Katmai, we have Glacier Bay. I would be very much in favor of another national park in the Wrangell Mountains, which I think is the most magnificent scenery on the North American continent. In fact, I recommended it for such action 30 years ago, and it would have gone through, but it was the eve of World War I, and it was not a suitable action at that time. And it would have been very appropriate at that time, because the Kennecott mine, which had been functioning, and was then closing because the copper ores there were believed to be exhausted, although subsequently we found that was not the case. But its facilities, its dormitories, and its buildings were going to be made available free of charge to the National Park Service. So we would have had in the Wrangell Mountains National Park something which we were unable to get for a half a century in Mount McKinley National Park, namely adequate facilities. Among the arguments that are advanced for these withdrawals is that the future of Alaska is with tourism. But our history has demonstrated that the Park Service, with one exception, has not ever supplied tourist facilities, and that in the limited season in Alaska, 3 months or 4 months at most, it is hardly possible for the concessionaire to both build and operate such facilities, hotels and sleeping facilities. Now, that's not true in the lower 48, where in such parks as Yosemite and Yellowstone, visitors come 12 months of the year, whereas in Alaska, they're limited to the summer months. And so if these vast areas are going to be set aside on the assumption that it's going to bring a lot of tourists, the tourists are going to have great difficulty in finding any place to go and stay, and they won't come. But actually, it's completely unnecessary. Now, the assumption has been, and the propaganda which justifies this, is that the American people, in their unwisdom, have desecrated and wrecked our environment in the lower 48 states, and that Alaska furnishes the last best hope, and it must not be allowed to happen here. And certainly the expression of that hope is very desirable, and I think we can all sympathize with it. Only the realities are far different. No one is desecrating the environment here. There isn't the slightest danger of doing it. No one in Alaska wants to do it. And the idea that an occasional mine or an occasional farm or an occasional business of some kind in an area of 80 million acres would despoil the environment is patently ridiculous. 80 billion acres is a tremendous area. It's an area larger than any state of the Union except the four largest, Alaska, Texas, California, Montana, area larger than the state of California. And to think that this area is going to be kept in wilderness, just lying fallow all these years, is the essence of economic wastefulness. Now, what can we do about it? Well, I think we've got to register, at least I feel, the most emphatic kind of protests throughout our government. But the Congress may be very difficult to convince, because the average congressman is very willing to be generous in Alaska, whereas if this took place in his own state and it were a conflict between a desirable economic development and some fancied conservationist need, he might decide either way. But up here, they're all going to decide that Alaska's got to be preserved as wilderness. So we've got to really educate them to the actual facts about it, that what is planned would keep this environment out of use, and that the alternatives of multiple use under adequate control would not do any damage either to wildlife or the environment. The fact of the matter is that our conservationist friends, Sierra Club, Wilderness Society, Friends of the Earth, don't seem to realize that conservation and development are not incompatible. Both are desirable, we need both, we should have both, and we can have both. And so this whole thing really is unnecessary. Certainly we can take precautions which have not been taken in the past in the lower 48 states, that when there is a mining enterprise, it need not be done in the reckless and careless and sloppy way in which it's been done in the past. The people who do the mining can be enjoined and compelled to clean up whatever mess they make around there. They can be made certain that they're not going to ravage the landscape, but the economy of Alaska would be greatly benefited. Now, as I say, this is an historic event because I'm convinced that if this happens, it's going to seriously jeopardize the economic future of Alaska. There'll be very large areas which are suitable for economic development that are going to be kept out of use with no suitable economic alternative. And as I say, this ties in with the fact that absentee controls and absentee actions have so frequently in the past dominated Alaska and have been brought by distant men, unseen men, acting in defiance of the expressed will or the known desire of the people of Alaska. And that is not good democracy, it's not good government, it's not consistent with our basic principles of government by consent of the governed, which, having achieved statehood, we should have here. So this is one subject that I want to recommend to your attention, although there are many other things that I could talk about. But before proceeding to other things, I wonder whether there are any questions, because I have thrown out a lot of ideas which I know are considered highly controversial and with which I'm sure there'll be plenty of disagreement. So if there are any questions, I'd be very glad to try and answer them, at least give you my views of them. And if you'd be happy to interpret the questions, because I may not quite understand them, I'll be glad to go ahead.
Are there any questions?
I have a question. I don't know very much about it, but I understand that there's a good possibility that the lands set aside will be explored for minerals, at least explored so we'll know what's there.
Who said so? There's no evidence of that.
Well, I heard a lecture by Dr. Whedon.
By whom?
Bob Whedon, Dr. Whedon.
I don't think he has any authority to make that statement.
He said that he was going down to Anchorage to hearings, and I don't know what the hearings were, but that was under discussion, and he just predicted that there's a possibility that that could happen.
Well, of course, experience has shown that once a federal agency gets a hold of something, they never let go. And we certainly can't go ahead and trust them with a vague hope that they may do these things. We've got to have it spelled out, legally or otherwise, before we go ahead and approve any such thing. And they shouldn't have the right to make the decision in any event. That decision should be made by the people of Alaska. Now, as I say, I think that we have a right to be concerned why the Alaska delegation, which is now opposed to this legislation, didn't oppose it when it hadn't taken place, when it appeared for the first time wholly irrelevantly in the Native Claims Bill, and why they didn't at that time say, well, let's wait a minute, hold this. This is a very far-reaching proposal. We don't think it belongs in this bill. Whoever is sponsoring it, and we know who is sponsoring it, is the conservation societies, should present it, if they want it, for separate legislation on which we can hold hearings and get all the pros and cons and get those in favor of it supporting it and those opposing it opposing it. But that was never done. So this thing was rushed through, and we're confronted with this reality.
Well, I consider it
very, very serious.
Yes. Can Congress now undo this? I mean, the Secretary of the Interior has taken this action.
The Congress, theoretically or actually, has got to pass on this sometime in the next few months or the next few years. And we've got to direct our energies to the Congress, but I say I don't feel too confident that the Congress will be concerned with the needs of one state. And they are going to be deluged with the very effective propaganda of the conservationist groups. And I don't want to leave it that way. I think we've got to move immediately, if possible, to try and negotiate some modifications. And as I say, and I want to repeat this for emphasis, that the sad part of all this is that it is so unnecessary. As I say, I would be the last person to want to do anything to diminish our supply of wildlife, which is of course wonderful, or to injure our environment. But none of these things that would completely satisfy a sane conservationist and also permit economic development would do these things. And that's what we've got to make understandable. Yes?
Your statement that nobody in Alaska wants to desecrate the...
Nobody wants what?
Nobody in Alaska wants to desecrate the environment. Looking at the aesthetic taste of the people that inhabit the state of Alaska, I wonder if anybody doesn't not want to desecrate the environment. And as far as...
He's saying that a lot of people here now have already desecrated the environment. Therefore, the evidence is that there are people here who already are desecrating the environment.
Well, specifically where?
I look now at some of the local economic interests regarding the logging, in the logging around here. And right now, there's a strong move to export the local harvest of logs to Japan. And when there is a very vital local need for that lumber right here in Fairbanks, and the Fairbanks companies are now saying we can't afford to sell the logs to people in Fairbanks because Japan is paying top dollar, and so we're going to go where the top dollar is. Is this in the economic interest even of Alaska? Are these the people you're asking us to trust to manage the land that you're afraid the federal government is going to keep forever?
Are these privately owned lands?
I can't say that for sure. It's whatever lands they are. No, it's not private land.
Is it forest land?
It's forest land that the local companies have to bid on with any other company that can bid for the lumber to have in reserve to harvest.
Well, I don't think that the issue of desecrating the environment is pertinent to whether they sell them here, sell them there. Maybe it's unwise economically, or it's unwise from the standpoint of the Alaskan interest.
I'm talking about the best interest of the people of Alaska, and I consider myself one of those people. And my best interests are evidently not being served by the people that probably will have the management of the...
Why don't you get your legislators to support an export tax? Why don't you have them pass legislation that would put an export tax on these logs? Wouldn't that discourage this? And
local loggers have consorted among themselves not to approach the governor to put an embargo. Or to put a ban on exporting lumber.
Well, I think that's a...
No, I can write letters, fine.
That's a matter that comes back to the people of Alaska securing the kind of measures through their representatives and their executive which will carry out their wishes. If their elected public servants don't carry out their wishes, the time to act is when they come up for re-election.
Yeah, well, they have several times.
That's part of the democratic process.
Are there any other questions on conservation and or development? Yeah.
To what extent do you think that the 80 million acre request was just their first move in a negotiating process, which clearly their interior is moving into with Congress, and they don't really have any hopes of maintaining all 80 million acres in the final?
I think there are some people, and quite a few, I hope, who would view this thing rationally and say, this is an arbitrary action. It hasn't, no one has consulted the people of Alaska on it. We're going to need this economic development, not only for the sake of Alaska, but we're going to need these strategic minerals. And we should pass legislation that'll modify the existing legislation. It could be done by an amendment to the Act, which would provide that under certain controlled circumstances, exploration of the subsoil would be permitted. That would go quite a ways. And that in addition, with an area set aside as a national park, the Park Service would have a responsibility to furnish accommodation, something of that kind. There are various things that could be done to modify the most adverse aspects of this legislation and make it possible to achieve some of these other objectives, and without actually necessarily completely repealing it, which has actually now been acted by the Congress. Now, if there are no more questions, I want to talk on another subject. As you know, some 11 months ago, President Nixon announced that he had ended the war in Southeast Asia. And he added that he'd ended it with honor, and he further said that he had created a peace that lasts. Well, none of those statements have any validity. He didn't end the war. It was ended by the Congress, which declared that after last October 15th, the bombing of Cambodia would have to stop, and that no further funds could be used for military purposes anywhere in Southeast Asia or off the coast of Southeast Asia. As far as being a peace with honor, and at that time President Nixon opposed the stopping. He was very unwise, he said, and he would have continued the bombing if Congress hadn't prevented it. As far as it's being a peace with honor, it is my view that nothing could have been more devoid of honor than the saturation bombing of a helpless peasant people who had no anti-aircraft guns, who had no planes, and upon whom we had rained death and destruction for 12 months, which was denied by Richard Nixon, who lied to the American people when he said it hadn't happened. And of course, as far as it's being a peace that lasts, it didn't last 24 hours. It's going to continue. And it's going to continue for several reasons. One reason is, it's going to continue as long as President Nixon insists on imposing our candidates, our characters on the people of those little countries. They have a right to determine their own destiny. And actually, the war goes on with the very same objectives that they've had for the last quarter of a century. The very same people are the descendants of the people who revolted against the French in the 1940s, because they wanted independence and freedom, continue today. Their motivation was very similar, analogous to that which motivated our founding fathers when they wanted to be separated from Great Britain and didn't want to be a colony. You know, in the 19th century, the European powers, France, Great Britain, Germany, Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, reached out into the less developed portions of the world, into Africa, Asia, and South America, and conquered various colonies. They created colonies in Africa, in Asia, and South America. But then, beginning in the 20th century, these colonies began to revolt. France gave freedom to Algeria and other countries. South American countries became independent. Spain and Portugal had to give up their dominion over Brazil and the other colonies. And the people of the French colony of Indochina wanted independence. The French didn't want to give up this colony and decided to fight to retain it. And in the 1950s, they actually came over here and asked us to assist them militarily. They came to President Eisenhower and urged him to send troops so that they could keep control of French Indochina. Well, President Eisenhower explored the situation and declined to do it, although he was strongly urged to send troops by his vice president, who was then Richard Nixon. And he was urged to do it by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Radford. But there were others, such as General Matthew Ridgway, who was Army Chief of Staff, who was guided by the wisdom of Douglas MacArthur, who had said, anyone who advises us to get into a ground war on the continent of Asia should have his head examined. Well, we did get into a ground war on the continent of Asia. And then we got in deeper and deeper, and instead of siding with these colonial revolutionaries, we sided with the other people. How did that come about? Well, after the French were defeated, a few months after Eisenhower took office, and in those few months, while he'd sent no troops, he had given them massive financial aid, four times more than the French put in, and he had sent a military mission, which consisted of some 600 men, to help train native troops to fight for the French. And that was the entering wedge, our military mission over there. But nevertheless, the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu in the late spring of 1954, and so a conference of 10 powers was called at Geneva, which came to the conclusion that out of the former French colony of Indochina, three new nations would be born, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and they would be independent and self-governing. Vietnam was to be temporarily divided, and only temporarily, for purposes of demobilization at the 17th parallel, but at the end of a two-year period, and not before the ending, and before the ending of it, there would be nationwide elections to determine who would rule this country. We agreed, the United States agreed, to support this provision of the Geneva Accords. But the puppet we had brought there and installed as the ruler of Vietnam, a man named Diem, who had been living in monastic retirement in the United States, was opposed to this, and made, let it be known that he would oppose it. And the United States, unfortunately, reneged on its own commitment and arbitrarily created the separate state of South Vietnam without any legal authority whatsoever. And this immediately intensified and perpetuated the war which had been going on for 10 years against the French and which goes on today. Because precisely that same problem is still unsettled and will be continued to be unsettled until the people of Southeast Asia determine their own destiny. Well, one other reason why the war goes on, besides the fact that their aspirations have not been satisfied, is that Richard Nixon is determined to impose these characters, whom he couldn't oppose when we were there with military means, with the largest army, Air Force and Navy in the world, through other means, by use of large sums of money, the use of mercenaries, the use of military not in uniform, but who serve to service the great amount of military aid we've already given Mr. Thieu, his client down there. In the current year, we are pouring $4.6 billion into Southeast Asia. It's absolutely shocking. This comes out of the pocket of all Americans. For no better purpose than Mr. Nixon can impose the people he wants to impose on the people of Southeast Asia. He has given them over $1 billion worth of sophisticated equipment before the ending of hostilities, which included planes, enormous quantities of munition, helicopters, and frigates, and has sent an army of mechanics to service these, because these people can't serve them themselves, as well as advisors. And the war will go on as long as that policy is pursued. And in addition to that, and particularly pertinent to our present energy shortage, is that we're also sending them hundreds of thousands of barrels of gasoline to fuel Mr. Thieu's planes. When we're being told to turn our thermostats down to 68 degrees and to drive at 50 miles an hour and to make other economies, and when our employment is spreading to all the airlines and elsewhere, we are still sending millions of barrels of this precious gasoline taken away from the American people to Southeast Asia. And if that isn't a valid subject for the protest by the American people, I don't know one. Before leaving Washington, I had written the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Bill Fulbright, asking him to open up this question and at least expose it to the public gaze. Of course, in my judgment, the Congress should immediately deny funds for this purpose, but the Congress hasn't been very energetic, and the first step, at least, would be to expose the facts so that the American people can find out just how much is costing us, how much we're doing down there, and whether that isn't a subject for congressional action. This is another example of where the distant officials carry out their own will, regardless of what many of us think are the best interests of the American people. Well, there's much else, of course, going on, but I think here are two issues which could concern all those who believe, as I do, that the democratic process, that the great experiment begun so hopefully by a group of the most enlightened men in the history of mankind 2 centuries ago, is worth preserving. And it has been in great danger of going down the drain. And if it hadn't been for the exposures in Watergate, which finally aroused a torpid Congress to some action and has aroused the American people somewhat, but not sufficiently, we would be in a police state. And I say that advisedly. For the first time in our history, we've had, up to very recently, a system of snooping and spying on the American people, completely foreign to our traditions. For the first time in our history, we've had 2 attorney generals, Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Kleindienst, who both urged the right to tap wires of anybody without a court order. I think we should be fully aware, I think most of you are, but perhaps I should spell them out, what this means. The only justification for tapping wires is when the police are definitely on the track of individuals they suspect of criminal action and want the evidence in order to bring them to court and to convict them. And when they have this evidence, they go to court and explain to the judge that they're on the track of such and such individuals, that they want to tap their wires in order to get evidence so they can bring them to court and try them. And if they can convince the court that this quest is legitimate, the court grants it for specific individuals for a limited time, and that's it. But under the desires of these 2 attorney generals, any one of us could be listened into. And the practice was that people who were opposed to the ideas of this administration should be listened into. And if necessary, if they continue to hold ideas contrary to those administration, that they should be harassed and annoyed with visits from the Internal Revenue Service. Now, this isn't fiction. This happens. I was in Massachusetts a few months ago, And I was talking to the minister of a Protestant Episcopal church in the suburb of Boston, Melrose. And this minister had been asked by a group of students after the Kent State massacre to give them a room in the basement of the church where they could protest against the continuation of the war and to the killing of those four students, three boys and one girl, by the National Guard when they were peaceably protesting against the continuation of the war. And he gave them a room in the basement where they held their peaceful protest, drafted resolutions against the continuation of the war, asking for an investigation of the Kent State affair, and sent their resolution in the newspapers. A couple of weeks later, this minister was visited by a representative of the Internal Revenue Service who said, "Reverend Radke, if you have another one of these meetings, your church will lose its tax-exempt status." Now, what did that mean? That was an attack on the three basic freedoms guaranteed in the First Amendment of the Constitution. Freedom of worship, for certainly agitation for peace is within the realm of the ministry. Freedom of assembly, because they would prevent these students from assembling on another occasion. And freedom of speech. This is the kind of thing that's been going on. For the first time in our history, this administration sought to exercise prior restraint on the publication of material in newspapers. Never before in our history has it happened. Never before has the administration said to a newspaper, "You shall not publish this." What did they want published? They didn't want the Pentagon Papers published, which had been supplied to the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe by Daniel Ellsberg, a public-spirited individual who felt that the information contained in the Pentagon Papers should be made available to the public, that the public had a right to know it. What was in the Pentagon Papers? The Pentagon Papers were a detailed history of the inside of the Pentagon during the war, which revealed in detail that while the Pentagon and the administration was issuing public statements to the effect that it was trying to stop the war, its officials were doing just the very opposite. And the public had a right to know that. What did the administration do? And one may ask, why did the administration want to prevent its publication? Because, after all, the misdeeds that were exposed were the misdeeds of officials under the Johnson administration, and one might wonder why a Republican administration would be anxious to cover up the misdeeds of a previous Democratic administration. Well, the answer was that these exposures did not merely expose the misdeeds of officials, individuals, but they exposed the folly and deception of this whole war. And Richard Nixon did not want the war discredited. He wanted to continue it. And so the administration took this case to court in the district courts of Boston, New York, and Washington. And in each case, the district court said, "No, this is in violation of the First Amendment. It's interference with freedom of the press. They shall be allowed to publish." The administration appealed this to the circuit court, the courts of appeal, in Boston, New York, and Washington. And they, again, upheld the idea of publication. And so the administration, still unsatisfied, took it to the Supreme Court of the United States, which by a 6-3 vote decided that the New York Times, the Globe, the Post, and others could publish. And among those three votes were the two and the only two Nixon appointees, Berger and Blackmun, who were willing to suppress this freedom of the press. And in the majority opinion, voiced by the late and great Justice Black, and concurred in by the one remaining great justice, Justice Douglas, it pointed out that if this opinion of the minority had become the opinion of the majority, the First Amendment would become a shambles, and it would have. So we were narrowly escaped there from a grievous assault on freedom of the press. And there's been much else. For the first time in history, newspaper men have been compelled to reveal their sources, which has been traditionally their right to conceal. Because if they are denied the right to conceal those sources, they will be denied to them in the future, and many stories which should reach the public never reach it. And there are many other such examples, as I say, such as the snooping and spying and the keeping of dossiers on people who are not allowed to know that these dossiers are being kept. So we've had a very narrow escape, and I would say that these are among the most serious crimes performed by the Nixon administration, more serious than the plain ordinary corruption which has been existed before. We've had corrupt administrations before, but never the multiplicity and diversity of criminality, which includes not only breaking and entry, burglary, perjury, bribery, extortion, and all the rest. The going into corporations and accepting contributions from them, which are known to be illegal, having previously apprised them that it would be in their interest to make these contributions, else they might suffer reprisals, a form of blackmail, which is almost without precedent, and much else. And then there are many other things. So that the nation faces another great domestic crisis to determine what are we going to do to get this nation back on the track and to try to restore the principles to which our founding fathers gave birth, namely, as I say, government by consent of the governed, a government of laws and not of men. And unless we can do that, the future of this nation is very doubtful. But I don't despair of the future of this country, provided the propaganda which has emanated from the administration, that what they did was more or less routine than has been done by previous administration, and that all administrations are more or less corrupt. This is absolutely false, and it certainly should be countered in order to make it clear to the younger generations that this system is worth preserving and can be preserved if only we will elect honest people, people of integrity, people of morals, and not people who are corrupt and who betray their oath of office when they get into office. And I can think of no message more important to the younger generation than they should get in and be activists and make the system work. Find out who are your candidates for public office. Find out what their record is. Find out what they stand for. And vote for them if you have confidence in that they will serve the public interest, and vote against them if you have reason to believe that they won't. And this is one of the immediate crying and pressing issues before us. Thank you.
Senator Greening is willing to take on questions at this point or any comments.
Senator Greening, should the president be impeached?
It's long overdue. He should have impeached months ago. He has violated the Constitution repeatedly. When he withholds funds from the Congress after his veto is overridden, he is violating the law, and he's done that repeatedly. When he made war without the consent of Congress, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution declares that only the Congress can declare war, he violated the Constitution. And he intensified that violation not only by deliberately concealing it, but deliberately concealing it by an elaborate mechanism of fraud by which the American people were actually told that their own sons and husbands who died there had died in Vietnam and not in Cambodia. A wholesale fraud, and there's much else of that kind. Now, he should have been impeached, and I think it's essential that he be impeached, because if he is not, if he's allowed to go virtually scot-free, as Spiro Agnew did, the American people will have a right to believe that there's one law for the rich and powerful and another law for the humble. If a man steals $5 worth of groceries for a hungry family, and he's caught, he goes to jail. But Spiro Agnew was extorting bribes and payments while he was occupying three important executive positions as the executive of Baltimore County, as governor of Maryland, and as vice president of the United States. And when he was finally found guilty not only of those things, but of violating the income tax provision, he got off with a slap on the wrist, a fine. And I think that's a disgraceful thing. And does much to weaken the confidence of people in our government and in the administration of justice. That was an executive action, of course. It was never given a chance to be tried. And I think it's very important that the impeachment proceed and that Nixon be tried fairly on these various offenses, and if convicted, impeached, and then be open to whatever punishment is due him.
Would you care to comment on what you think is the likelihood of the impeachment proceeding leading to a trial?
Well, I don't think it's at all certain. I think that it is presumably promoted by the confirmation of Gerald Ford as vice president. That was given as the argument of a number of senators and congressmen whose vote for Ford was, I thought, rather shocking. He was confirmed on the ground that he had proved that he had never stolen anything. Didn't seem to me to be wholly all the necessary qualifications for possibly being president. But it was believed that if he were installed, it might be easier to impeach the president because no one wanted to impeach him while a crooked vice president such as Spiro Agnew would then become president automatically. But I think there will be further revelations before we get through. The Watergate is a kind of an expanding affair. When we first heard about Mr. Nixon getting a lot of financial help for his various estates, Key Biscayne and the one in California and the hideout in the Bahamas, it was reported that the $35 million had been spent. Well, it's now become $100 million and much else. And it was justified in the interest of security, heating a swimming pool, because presumably he might catch cold in that cold California climate if the swimming pool weren't heated, and such other absurdities as that. But I think the chances of his impeachment are getting better every day, and I think it should be carried through.
There was another question over here.
Yeah, Senator, under the guise of revenue sharing, this administration has done a job of tearing down DHEW and the health programs.
Repeat that out loud.
What could you do to, what would you suggest be done to combat that?
Under the guise of revenue sharing, the administration...
Well, take it loud, so that we all can hear it.
The administration has been cutting back on social programs under the guise of revenue sharing. What can be done about putting these back together again?
Well, it all goes to the desirability of having another administration. Nixon has cut down on such things as health, wealth, hospitals, pollution abatement, various things that the people want, but never a nickel off our bloated military budget. This is another problem which concerns us. What is called defense is no longer defense, it's global meddling. An entering wedge was started when the name of the department was changed from War Department and Navy Department to Defense Department. Because in the old days, when we had a War Department or a Navy Department, if the public felt that we were building too many ships needlessly in the Navy or had too many troops, we could protest, but no one can protest against defense. Defense is sacred, like motherhood. So that the mere fact that it's called the Department of Defense makes it very difficult to criticize it, but it should be criticized because it's gone far beyond defense, which should consist of being sufficiently strong so as to repel any attack upon us if it were to be made. But we've gone beyond that. Now, the Pentagon budget, which is now about $80 billion a year, and is going up to, foreseeably to $100 million, then $150 million, is only a small part of it. There's also a program called mutual security, under which we give massive financial aid to some 50 foreign countries, including such countries as Morocco and Ethiopia and Turkey and Portugal and Spain, particularly the fascist countries. And this is supposed to make us more secure. I don't feel any more secure when I learned that last year we gave $20 million to Ethiopia. I think it was a terrible waste of money and doesn't is without any justification. And it always seems to be that we give this money to the countries that are ruled by dictators, the colonels in Greece and the generals in Brazil and elsewhere. And this is global meddling, which is going to get us into more trouble, into more Vietnams, and in my judgment, is completely unnecessary. But most of all, it's so costly that there will never be money enough for our long-needed, neglected economic programs, which cost millions of dollars, whereas these military expenditures run into billions, tens of billions, and completely unnecessary. And the delusion is constantly propagated by the military-industrial complex against which President Eisenhower warned us in his historic farewell message, but which is now firmly in the saddle and which is making billions of dollars out of defense and which has control of a great many members of Congress because they have these defense factories in their district and they are clearly apprised by the workers in these factories that if this particular enterprise is shut down, there'll be so many more unemployed in the district. But actually, the place to do the cutting down is not so much at home, although it could be done substantially there, but abroad, overseas. There's no reason why we should continue to keep 300,000 troops in Europe at our expense for a quarter of a century. The very least we could do would be to ask the European nations to pay their share, if not all of it, since this is in their defense, instead of expecting our taxpayers to do it. And this is another problem which is deeply embedded in this administration, which has supported all militarism, and which we would hope that a change of administration might alter.
One more question.
Yes, Senator Greening, looking back in the retrospect with all the problems that the Alaska government has had with the federal government, why wasn't the idea of U.S. Commonwealth status entertained back in the mid-50s instead of just statehood status?
What was that?
Why not Commonwealth status for Alaska rather than statehood status when the question was being considered?
Well, we thought we wanted the full measure of self-government. Under Commonwealth status, we wouldn't necessarily have had two senators and a representative in Washington. Why stop halfway on a very dubious status which wouldn't have given us the independence we thought at that time that statehood would secure? Now we are facing the very disappointing fact that statehood hasn't freed us from some of these restrictions, and a movement has started in Anchorage for secession. It hasn't reached a serious stage yet. Maybe it's just in the joke stage. And for the moment, perhaps we should not consider it too seriously. But if we're going to find that we do not have government by consent of our government, if we're still ruled by distant bureaucrats, maybe we should consider secession. In that case, we would have control of our own resources. We would have control of the vast oil resources we have. And maybe, like the Arabs, we could blackmail Uncle Sam and say, unless you treat us right, you won't get our oil. And I don't expect this to happen, but maybe that would be a good way to celebrate the bicentennial. After all, a revolution is a respectable performance. We did it 200 years ago. Maybe we'll have to do it again in order to secure those rights which the Founding Fathers declared to be inalienable, but apparently have been alienable.
Perhaps on that note, I better exercise the prerogative of the chair and thank Senator Greening for being with us. You've honored us by being with us, Senator.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
But let's all keep fighting.